Good morning. Isn't it a delightful thing to be able to wake up and say, good morning, God, rather than good God, it's morning. I want to thank the committee for inviting us down. This has been, up until this moment, a delightful weekend. We have thoroughly enjoyed it. I don't know how that I got this position of cleanup at this great convention. I guess I would answer sort of like the old cranky 90-year-old man. Somebody asked him, to what did he attribute his long years of life? And he said, I don't know. I just guess a whole lot of hard luck. But it's not easy to follow this series of speakers that we've had here. They have been wonderful. I'm Bill Johnston. There's nothing ever wrong with me. A drink of liquor won't make worse, because I'm an alcoholic, and I can't take any form of alcohol or tranquilizer or narcotic or any other substitute. Alcoholism, to me, is a progressive emotional disorder which is manifested and aggravated and advanced and generally made worse by the continued use of alcohol and or other narcotics. I believe, too, particularly in my case, that there is an enzyme or glandular deficiency in the greater majority of us. And, of course, we know it is a mental obsession and a physical allergy. But the longer I stay in AA, the more I know that this is a spiritual illness. And thank God we have a spiritual program by which we can recover. You know, I think that the basis of all of our troubles and character defects, be you alcoholic or not, is centered around fear. And I mentioned a moment ago that emotions play a part in our lives, particularly mine. And I think certainly the first 6 years of our lives determine a great bit of what our character will be like. And speaking of fear, I have read, and I believe, and it makes sense to me, that even prenatally, before we're born, we have two fears. In our mother's wombs, we're conscious of being carried, and we therefore have a fear of falling. We also hear loud noises, and we don't understand them, and this scares us. So we have a fear of loud noises. Now, I don't know about other newborn babes, and I don't really know about myself, but knowing myself now and looking back in retrospect, I can very easily and with comfort say that when I was born and the doctor held me up by my heels and whacked me across the rear end, and when I hollered out, I hollered because he hit me and not some other youngster. Here, even an unnamed, scrawling, bawling baby hollers out, look out, who in the heck are you hitting? In other words, I came into this world a greedy, self-centered individual who was seeking peace of mind and comfort for me first, and I would remain this type of a character until such time in my life that circumstances or events or the grace of God or suffering or spiritual discipline or a combination of all, but mostly the grace of God in my case, that I could get out of myself and into God and on to others. And this is what my story is all about. Now, I was born into a family, and of the six in the family, five were either addicted to alcohol or narcotics or both. And I was born on Groundhog Day, some half a century and a little over ago, up in the mountains of western North Carolina. My father was an alcoholic. My mother was addicted to narcotics. I had an older sister addicted to both, another sister an alcoholic. And then I got this oddball brother who's not addicted to anything. He is allergic to work, I have discovered, though. My father was a very prominent and outstanding attorney, not only in his immediate town or county, but throughout the whole mountain district. He was about so high, weighed 260 pounds, and he roared like a lion and literally shook the earth when he walked, and I was mortally scared to death of him. My mother was an addict of narcotics from the time that I first knew her until her death. A beautiful, lovely, charming, highly educated woman. Very immature, but very brilliant. She was never to recover. She died. I had to put her in a state hospital at one time. She died later down here in Jacksonville. A mere shadow of a formerly beautiful and lovely woman. She weighed about 60 pounds. I had very mixed emotions about her, because I loved her dearly and I hated her bitterly at the same time. My father, in the last 10 years of his life, was sober. There was no AA up in the mountains then. I think he had some sort of a spiritual experience. He was in our state senate for 2 terms. He was on the Superior Court bench the last 7 years of his life. And he had a reputation of being most lenient and considerate of drunken cases. And he said the greatest law book ever written was the Holy Bible. And this didn't sound like the same man I used to know. He became the most lovable character I ever knew. My older sister was a charming, lovely, beautiful girl, graceful. Had everything that I should think any girl would want in life. She had 3 good marriages. Drank them all up. Her first one, she married the bishop's son. And I've heard her in a little ill temper said she married the son of a bishop. This girl, she was unamenable to any suggestion of facing reality. She had even dealt in the traffic of narcotics, and she spent some time over in Lexington over there. And she was found dead in a hotel room with an empty Saginaw bottle and an empty fifth bottle. I have another sister who's an alcoholic, and this past July she was 21 years in AA. Now, she had a tough go of it to begin with. Here she was, a Southern alcoholic Catholic Democrat married to a Yankee non-alcoholic Republican. And it was tough on both of them, I'm sure. And of course, I'm an alcoholic, and this brother of mine is oddball. I don't think he'll ever make it. He'll pour a drink about so big, and if the doorbell ring, he'll leave the drink and go to the doorbell. That won't work. My father was a very successful man in making money. He'd make $25,000, $30,000 a year. But he and the family would spend $35,000 or $40,000. And you just don't get anywhere that way. There was a lot of hospitalization going on, a lot of fights and so forth and so on. And being the baby of this brood, I was put in a boarding school when I was 5 years of age. And the next year, another school somewhere. The next year, I was sent off up into Virginia to live with an aunt. And looking back in retrospect, I can see possibly how a little feller get the idea of his family keeps sending him off that he ain't wanted. And this creates feelings of rejection and abandonment and resentment. And you can't do this without feeling guilty. And guilt is an illness within itself. But what does a human personality do under such conditions? I'm advised that under most any sort of a crisis, be it a slow creeping thing or a sudden thing, that most individuals will, it's either fight or flight. but not the potential alcoholic, not this one. He stands straight and he looks brave. He's scared to death. He don't know what to do. So he starts acting and pretending. And to do this, you have to become a liar, so to speak, and I took to it very naturally. God had either given me three very wonderful attributes or three curses, because I had the constitution of a rhinoceros, the stubborn will of a mule, and a photographic memory. Now, boy, this is real equipment to lie and drink liquor. I know that my wife could ask me about some yarn I'd told her, say, 6 months before, and I'd repeat it to her verbatim and throw in a couple of extra lies just to give it color, you know. I was about as bad as old Senator Irvin's friend Huckleberry Tart up in Rowan County at home. Huck was so famous for telling lies that people really enjoyed him. One fellow stopped Huck one morning and he said, "Huck, come here and tell me a lie." Huck says, "I ain't got time. The Yadkin River's on fire. I got to go put it out." I got where I'd climb a thorny tree to tell a lie when I could have stayed on the ground and told the truth and made $10. But finally, they sent me away again. When I was 13, they sent me to a military school. And surprisingly enough, I liked it. And I didn't figure out why I liked it until I got into AA and started figuring myself out a little bit. But at home, we'd have good years, we'd have bad years. I'd wear new clothes one year, and then for a couple of years, I might wear my brother's clothes. And we lived in 19 or 20 different residences from the time I was 6 till I was 20, in the best, the worst, and the in-between, and then back and forth through the series again, all over town. And this is frustrating. But when I was in military school, I wore the same uniform as everybody else. I went to the same classes, I ate the same food, and I knew darn well I could shine my shoes and polish my brass as well, and better than anyone else. I could march as well. And so I felt that I had an even and a fair competition. Of course, on the weekends and other times, this was bad. Actually, they had no business sending me to a military school. We could not afford it. And even though we pretended we could, my mother had some notion that her daughters should go to Catholic convents and her boys to military schools, keeping up with the Joneses or something, I don't know. But I did like it there. But in just about the start of my second year there, the big depression caved in around home, and it was a bad one. Boy, in my hometown, it wasn't safe to go down the street. People were jumping out of windows so bad. Now, this is the truth. So they said I'd have to go home. Well, this is the best thing that ever happened to me up till this time, because I didn't want to go home. I liked it there. And the last time I'd gone home, I couldn't find the house. They'd moved, and there was a lot of turmoil there. So I stayed there and worked my way through school. Now, this sounds like a very creditable sort of a thing, you know, a self-made man working his way through school. Baloney. I just didn't want to go home. And I waited on tables and fired furnaces and blew a bugle. And the next year, I found that I had some athletic ability, and I was never again to pay to go to school or college. But the real best thing happened also in that second year. I found this beverage, alcohol. If you can call that white Georgia stump hole liquor a beverage, my God. I got this liquor from a bootlegger in the garage of the Dixie Hunt Hotel in Gainesville, Georgia. And he kept this liquor in a giant truck inner tube. And you know, with that lye and fusel oil and that rubber flavor, it was mighty good drink. Now, of course, this liquor, it made me drunk and it made me sick. But somewhere between that first drink and throwing up, it made me something else. It made me belong. It made me feel more acceptable to society, and it made society much more acceptable by me. It made me about a foot and a half taller and put steel wool on my chest. It fixed me where I was almost comfortable. I never got completely free of my inhibitions and fears. Because I went around, my palms perspired, I was nervous, and I never appeared this way. I always appeared to be quite comfortable. I guess I was just a born fraud. Now, fraud in legal terminology is a false representation of material fact, and this is just what I was. Probably right now I look very calm and comfortable and this, that, and the other. The truth is, I'm about to vomit. So, you people on the front row, Lib, you should have known better. But this beverage, alcohol, it really was my juice. Oh, man, this was something. It even fixed me where I could sing and dance, which I couldn't do without it. And it really was the answer for me. This beverage is something. In later years, I was to discover that it'd make you see double and feel single, a fact that I'm not proud. This was to become the pattern for the next 30 years. Now, my father, on seeing me drunk, admonished me that if you're going to drink, you better learn to hold it. This is the code of the hills. And you know, for a mountaineer, I started drinking quite late in life. They tell a story back home there of a little old town called Hayesville. They had a bench built around the trunk of a tree, and there's a little old boy sitting there and drinking a home brew and smoking a crook cigar and reading a copy of the Whiz Bang, Mary. And this old needle-nosed woman with a black hat and whatnot come over and poked him with an umbrella and said, "Boy, why ain't you in school?" He said, "Heck, woman, I ain't but 4 year old." So I was quite old for a mountaineer when I started. And social drinking has been mentioned here. Up in the mountains, the only thing we know about social drinking is one guy says, "I think I'll go get some liquor and get drunk." And another guy says, "Social eye." So, yeah, the mountaineers, they take a lot of jokes, you know. But anyway, I left military school and went on to college and went on athletic scholarship. I went to Wake Forest, and by George, they didn't get upset yesterday again. All year long, they've been getting upset, but they got through yesterday. And, you know, in college, an athlete in particular, he likes to acquire a nickname, you know, like Galloping Ghost or Crazy Legs or something of this sort. And I hadn't been there 60 days when I had gotten myself a nickname. It didn't have anything to do with athletics, but I was known as Whiskey Bill. Now, isn't that something to write home about? Not because I was drunk all the time or anything, because I didn't appear that way. I was either going after liquor or coming back with it or on a party or sleeping one off or planning one. And I think if I had engaged in what they call training, then I might have made a name for myself as an athlete. I had flashes of brilliance in football and in track. One Saturday morning in a meet against Davidson College with the worst hangover I'd ever had in my life up to that point, I broke the college 100-yard dash record, and if there'd been a jug of liquor at the end of the track, you'd have read about a new world record, too. But in spite of alcohol, I had a satisfactory athletic and academic career. I could remember most of the things from the lectures, and if I couldn't, I could read laterally all the way across the room. That's known as cheating. Even at this point in my life, I can look back and very clearly identify myself. I was a real fraud because I looked like a prince and I was a darn bum. I looked like a scholar and I was a dunce. I appeared to be generous and outgoing and friendly, and I was not. I was very greedy and selfish. Any charity that I showed at all, I was doing it to be a big shot or buying favor. I had some ulterior motive. And as I look in the epilogue of the big book and see Herbert Spencer's quotation there, it says, "There is a principle which is a bar against all information and proof against all argument and cannot fail to keep man in everlasting ignorance. And that principle is contempt prior to investigation." In other words, a closed mind. And this is what I had. Old Clancy I out in Los Angeles, he says that all of us have got a little imaginary switch up here to cut our mind on and off when we want to open it and listen and so forth and so on. And when something comes up we don't want to hear or whatnot, we just turn it off. Well, when I was born, mine was locked in the off position. I didn't even have to reach up there. I wasn't getting anywhere in life over there, and I needed money to live the way I wanted to live. So I left there and went to Raleigh and went to work. And imagine of all things, with the treasury, state treasury department. But along this time, this brother of mine, who was a brilliant student, my father wanted him to be a lawyer. He didn't want to be a lawyer, he wanted to be an engineer. And he had failed the bar examination 4 or 5 times. And so, big-hearted me, I decided to go to law school at night. And this would get a check from home every now and then, too, you know. And law came to me very nicely, and I enjoyed it, and I finished the course. And I think it's a 4-year course. And yet, I was never to take the bar examination. I went into service a month before I would have taken it. And when I came out of service, they had changed the laws. I had to go back to college. And in the meantime, my father had died, and I didn't have a ready-made practice to go into. And I never had passed any other bar, so I don't know why I would have passed that one. But in 1938 and 39, I met and pursued and courted this lovely creature here, and we were married. And I guess of what this stupid thing here thought, well, here is the answer to all of the lost and denied love that I had sought all my life. The only thing that I needed was for someone to love me, and here was the answer. Of course, we all know now that our answer lies in nothing human at all. And if she could have done it, she would have. She has been a treasure to me. She was a very disgusting drinker. I would look down my nose at her or anyone else who would not hold their liquor and behave themselves. She'd get tight and silly and kick up her heels and vomit and embarrass me no end. And yet, talking about a drink the next day, she didn't want one for 3 months. She never had a problem with it. In fact, I doubt if she ever drinks now. I don't know. Occasionally she might. But here I was the one that the crowd, if we were going to the beach or the mountains or something, the crowd would say, well, let Bill drive, he'll get us there and he'll get us back. If someone got in trouble with the law or something, say, well, get Bill, he'll straighten it out, and I would. And here I was holding liquor up to here all the time. I developed this enormous capacity for it. And you know, to the point when I came into AA, several of my friends in there said, what are you doing here? I didn't know you had a problem. I never saw you drunk. Well, I took a little figuring, but after about 6 months of sobriety, I figured it out. They had never seen me sober. How would they know the difference? I went in military service in 1942, and old big volunteer, you know, and this, that, and the other, going to go in and bite a cannon in two or something, all this crazy stuff. And I went in as a private, and I came out as a major. Now, here again, this sounds as a very creditable thing. Well, so what? I had been in military since I was 13 years of age. I had been commissioned in the infantry and let it lapse on me for not going to camp. So naturally, when I was put into a civilian army, I stood out like a sore thumb, and I got promotions. Now, OCS, at the time that I hit that, I caught one of these classes where the table of organization was way down, and there's 3,300 of us went into class, and only 800 graduated, and I finished in the top of my class. Strong back and a good memory. I got through. I even attained some position in service. I was director of military training of an enormous base out in Texas. And I never got out of the country, even though I had my orders, my request on the desk every Monday morning for overseas duty. I got to Mexico a couple of times to buy some liquor and perfume. And finally, when the war was over, I didn't have any points. I was up in Ohio, and I was commanding officer of a separation center there. And I saw some orders where qualified personnel could transfer to Park Avenue in New York and go to personal affairs school and then transfer to the Veterans Administration. And you know whose names were on the orders first. I got out of there and into it. And my first permanent station with this government agency was in Goldsboro, North Carolina. My office was in the courthouse, a half a block from the Elks Club. And you know where I stayed most of the time. My nearest superior was in Winston-Salem. I've got to correct that. I said superior. At this stage of my life, nobody was superior to me. My nearest senior was in Winston-Salem, a couple hundred miles away. I was drinking all I could buy and chisel off of other people. And yet there was no noise on the home front. I was paying my bills. And weekends started getting a little longer. Rather than closing the office on Friday and going back Monday, it was Thursday and Tuesday. And if I was progressing into alcoholism at this time, the next 10 years would have made it look like I was wading around in shallow water. Because I applied for and attained the position as executive director of the North Carolina Association of Beer Distributors. Now, if you can imagine anything any more wonderful than this, this was it. All the free beer, wine, and whiskey that I wanted to drink. All conventions and politics and traveling and going. This little mountain boy really had it. And I had a salary at a figure which I never dreamed that I would have attained if I'd worked till I was 65. And I was really a big shot. Got to messing around in politics and all of this sort of thing, but I reached the real zenith of my career when I became a lobbyist in the legislature. Now, this to me was the greatest thing that could happen. And I took great credit for my accomplishments with that body, particularly in the Senate there. And then these darn AA folks make you get honest with yourself. Now, look back. Those people in the House and Senate were doing favors for me through out of respect of my father and his memory. He had been president pro tem of the Senate. They loved him. I looked just like him, talked just like him, and I was about 50 pounds heavier then. And I can very honestly look back and know that I was using a lot of his mannerisms and telling his old jokes. I even told experiences that I had, which were really his experiences. I know one particular case I was telling somebody about going on a bear hunt up on Cataloochee River. And they would listen to it, just you could hear a pin drop. I ain't never been on Cataloochee River. I've never even been bear hunting. It was my daddy that did these things. And I lived in one of these twice removed worlds all the time. But I got very arrogant and conceited, and I even got so confident of myself that I would resign from this wonderful job occasionally. But I'll promise you that each time I resigned, I would have just accomplished something very important for the industry, like opening up some new territory or getting a tax reduction on a certain package. And they would say, well, you can't do this. We need you. And this would build your ego up. And you say, well, all right, how about a raise? So I got 3 raises this way. And I resigned again the fourth time. And they again declined it. Then they went home and got sober and sent a committee back on Monday and said, we've changed our mind. Well, you know we're smart. And I figured this out beforehand. A year before, I'd taken a part-time contract with a very fine insurance company and was doing business. Had trained myself. And I got to interrupt myself right here because I was thinking about it. At that time, with all this salary and legitimate expense account, plus what I could steal, with my insurance business on the side and a note at about three different banks, I was broke all the time, miserable and hurting, and buying my wife fine presents to keep her off my back and whatnot. Come to find out she didn't even want them, really. And last year, on just a fourth of what I used to make, I'd be doggone if I didn't save half of it and gave more than I ever have in my life. And it's wonderful. I was always worried about the high cost of living. And to find out it was the cost of high living that was bothering me. Well, during this period of time, I was hospitalized four or five times. Never alcoholism. It was enterogastritis or hypertension or sprained back, various different things. And no doctor ever mentioned to me that I was drinking too much. And I was drinking an awful lot of whiskey. With this job that I had, there was never any question said about it. If you were drinking on the job, I was sort of promoting their product, I reckon. But I would start at 7 in the morning and drink until the TV cut off at night, or when the gambling game broke up, whichever it was. The bed in which I slept was wringing wet from head to heel with this stinking alcoholic perspiration. No number of baths seemed to get me clean. Now, I won't go into any account of my ill behavior while drinking, because I'll promise you that your cruelest imagination would be kind in comparison with the true facts. I was a stinker. I know all about the DTs and the convulsions and the blackouts. I've sat on the side of the bed many a time with one shoe on and one off, not knowing whether I was getting up or going to bed, or what town I was in. I'd leave the house to go get a loaf of bread and come back 2 weeks later with no bread. Go to New York for a four-day meeting and stay 2 weeks. And I know that I caused my wife many, many heartaches. I was drinking then about four pints of whiskey a day. And I sometimes see people raise their eyebrow. Well, if you divide that into a 16-hour drinking day, that's not but 4 ounces an hour. And some of my friends in the mountains would have thought I was tapering off on that. But I tell you what, I used to drink Glenmore. Now, I went over to Owensboro, Kentucky a couple of years ago, and they were driving by there, the Glenmore distillery from Evansville to Owensboro. And as our car went by the distillery, they lowered the flag to half mast. But things got awfully rough around our house. And one Sunday morning, a hot May Sunday morning, this sweet, demure, and lovely, calm, soft-spoken little lady that you see and know now, I saw her when she looked like hell wearing a bonnet and could make more noise than a truckload of turkeys going through the Holland Tunnel. I'll tell you that. Well, this Sunday morning, she went into a fit of temper, and before she got out of it, liked to have beat me to death. Now, you talk about self-pity, and have you ever seen Joe Bliff in Little Abner with the cloud that falls around him and dropping raindrops on him? Well, I was leaving. I'm telling you, I was getting out of that place. And when it came time to leave, I couldn't find my car keys, my bill folder, and I started walking the 4 miles to town. I dare not go in anyone's house to use a phone to get a taxi or anything. I was too beat up. And I walked in the rain all the way to the Sir Walter Hotel, and you can imagine of the horrible resentments and things that went on in me in that four-mile trip. But I packed up and I left. I severed connections with everybody and everything in Raleigh, and took off to Orlando, Florida, where I would secure a divorce. There ain't nobody going to treat me like that. And Orlando is 630 miles from Raleigh, or 6.5 pints of Glenmore, whichever way you want to measure it. I don't even know where I stayed the first night. But when I drove into my brother's yard there in Orlando, they had just moved there, relatively newcomers there, My sister-in-law came out and she looked at me and she said, "Well, it doesn't look like anything wrong with you." See, she'd been in touch with some of those lying people up there in Raleigh. And I said, "It's not. I was very bloated, but I never looked drunk. My eyes would clear up after 3 drinks in the morning. Or 6, take 3 maybe to come back." But she noticed in my belongings there that I had a Book of Common Prayer. And I had given a what you would call a social whirl at the Episcopal Church. And she wanted to know if I'd take her to church. So I couldn't have looked too badly if she wanted me to take her to church. My brother doesn't go to church, or didn't. I don't know whether he does now or not. I said yes, and wanted to get it over with. I said, "We'll go next Sunday." And something happened. She couldn't go. And several weeks went by. And finally, on the 4th of July, I told her, I said, "Let's go to church tomorrow." She said, "All right." Now, in order to go, I had to have myself something to keep me from breaking out in sweats and shaking. I took 2 or 3 drinks and a lot of chlorophyll. It was hot, brother, in Orlando, Florida in 1959. It was hot on July the 5th. And we got in the car, and she being a stranger and I also, we stopped. We had policemen at each street corner directing traffic. A lot of people there. Why I stopped at the 3rd policeman rather than the 5th or the 7th, I don't know. Didn't know then. I think now it was divine guidance. Because I asked this policeman where the nearest church was. I didn't specify denomination. He said, "Turn to the right. There's a church at the end of the block." And I pulled up in front of St. Michael's Episcopal Church, the identical name and denomination of the church that adjoins my back lot in Raleigh and to which I belong. Well, I felt better because I would at least be familiar with the service. And when we went in, it was rather a large church. I got about 30 yards down the aisle there. And as ushers generally do, they handed me a bulletin. And this is all right until I looked at it and I nearly fainted. Because this bulletin, a copy of which I have here, had the picture of a drunk on it, passed out at a table with his bottle and ashtray and glass there. And I knew I'd walked into the worst trap that had ever been set. And that my wife had planned every bit of it. And she didn't even know for sure where I was. I couldn't get out, so I sat in that pew on my hands, waiting for this hellfire, brimstone, prohibition sermon that was going to pour down right on me, like they always do. But the little man didn't mention drinking or alcoholism or anything about it. And he went right along with the regularly assigned sermon for that particular Sunday. And I went out of that church. I took that bulletin with me, something that I never did unless I needed evidence I'd been, and I had a witness that morning. And it was several weeks later that I was to read on the back of this church bulletin an article about alcoholism and the miraculous work being done by a fellowship known as Alcoholics Anonymous. My first conscious knowledge of AA as it might affect me. Excuse me. Of course, this sister of mine had been in, but I hadn't seen her. She was living up in Boston somewhere. I thought that AA was like the YMCA, Salvation Army, or Red Cross. These things these people need, I thought they were wonderful things. But this, as it might apply to me, was the first knowledge that I had of it. Well, my wife came down there to see me. She knew that it only took a short while to get divorced down there, 3 months, and I'd been there a little over 2 months. She didn't want to lose this prize package, so she came down to break it up, see. Well, we were reconciled, and I forgave her for all of her meanness and sorriness. And this is truly the way I felt. But I did promise to come back to Raleigh and to do something about my drinking, which I did. I drank more. And you know, about the only way I could do that was start drinking between drinks, because I was drinking all I could then. Well, things got awfully bad around home there. I couldn't quit drinking. Talking about the first step, I knew that I was an alcoholic 8 or 9 years before I came to AA. But I didn't think that my life was unmanageable or that I was powerless over drinking. I was powerless over quitting, but not powerless over drinking. And my life was manageable as long as I could make money and hold down a job and drive and not get arrested. I was the best drunken driver you ever saw. But things got awfully bad. She sent for this sister of mine who was in AA, and she came down from Boston. And she knew better than to try to shove AA down my throat. And she went away, I think very discouraged, but she told my wife that she thought there was some hope. It might have to get worse before it got better, but there was some hope because she thought I believed in God. Well, now I did, because at this stage of my alcoholism, it was a good idea to believe in anything that sounded good. I was sort of like the old town drunken reprobate who was hit by a car and he was about to die. And his doctor told him he was about to die and asked him, didn't he want a priest or a pastor? The man said, yeah, get me a pastor. And so the pastor came and he told him, he said, my good man, you're about to die and now is your last chance. You must accept God and denounce the devil. And he said, well, now, preacher, I'm going to accept God, but I ain't going to denounce the devil. He said, well, you can't do that. This is inconsistent. He said, yes, I can. He said, why, man? He said, preacher, with my past reputation and the uncertainty of my future, I can't antagonize anybody. And that, of course, I was in a position where I couldn't antagonize anybody, too. But things changed around the house there for some reason or another. Lib had been going to some open AA meetings and disappearing around there, one thing or another. And I got awfully frustrated about the situation because rather than slamming doors and nagging and screaming and hollering and one thing or another, she became very soft of toe and mild of lip and very pleasant. And this is the worst thing you can do to an alcoholic. One day I was home with a virus, you know, the viruses, and she called out of the house and said she's on the way to on home and won't know if I need anything. I said, no, everything seemed to be all right. She said, well, do you have plenty of whiskey? And I nearly dropped the phone. I thought she had the wrong number. Anyway, the following Monday morning, I was supposed to go on jury duty. And there wasn't any way I could figure out that I could get a drink every 20 minutes in the courthouse, or particularly in the jury box, and I didn't know where the judge kept his. I knew he was an alcoholic. So the only thing a respectable alcoholic can do is you put yourself in the hospital, and I did. And while I was there, I read this article, and while I was there, some other literature appeared from places unknown to me. And old Haslam came to see me after I called him, and Mary Alice, and some others. I'd been in there about 10, 12 days then. And on the following Monday night, they let me have a pass to go to an AA meeting. I had a short parole there. And I went to the Hayes Barton group there in Raleigh. And the only thing I can remember about the meeting was that they had nice, soft, cushioned chairs with arms on the chairs that I could hold on to. This is all I mean. I think I'd have flown out of there if they hadn't had those arms on that chair. I came back on Friday night to another meeting, and I was on pass from the hospital. I got back to that hospital at 2 o'clock in the morning, went into convulsions again. Let me tell you, I'd been rode hard and put up wet. But when I got out of there, I came into AA just like everything I'd ever done before, just like a ball of fire. Man, let me tell you something. I was just doing things in a hurry. I took one good look and read the 12 steps and took them by the dozen. That's all there was to it. Oh, I was out talking real soon when I ought to have been listening. And when I was talking, I wasn't talking AA. I was entertaining. I even had gimmicks and props. I had me a bottle with a pink snake wrapped around and he'd bite you. Oh, real showman. And I was saying what I thought the people would like to hear so I would be popular, see. Same old phony, he just wasn't bending the elbow. And after 7 months of this charade, and my wife, like most people, civilians, felt like you cut the liquor off, everything's going to be fine, and she reverted back to stomping and slamming doors and nagging and talking about work and money and things like that. And So I just found myself what I thought was a justifiable reason to jump back in the bottle. Now, I had quit for 6 months once before this, or twice before in the last 12 years. And the last time I quit for 6 months, which is just before going to AA, I drank for 23 months as much as I could drink. I said, now this time, after 7 months sobriety, if I do a little controlled drinking, I can drink for 3 years. And in 5 weeks' time, I was climbing the walls over an alcoholic rehabilitation center in Butner, North Carolina. I got no compensation, no reward whatsoever from this alcohol. It did not suppress any hostility and violence in me. It did not give me any comfort whatsoever. It made me extremely violent. This girl that I love so very, very much, I ran her away from home, fearful for her life. My rector, he came over and I ran him off, and he wasn't too sure about his safety either. I got a lot of guns and things there in the house. And I broke up things, and I burnt furniture, and I denounced God, and I even burned a picture of Jesus Christ. Now, this is how low a human being can get. Skid Row, the gutter, talk about it if you want. I think it's in your soul. It's not a geographical location. And that's where I was. Oh, but here again, God knocked on my door in the form of the mailman. And he brought me a little package of 6 of these little black books 24 hours a day. You see, I'd been buying these and giving them to newcomers and friends and whatnot, not having bothered to have read it at all. And when it came on St. Patrick's Day, I tore that package open. I couldn't hold the little book in my hand. I was shaking so badly. I took about 3 drinks, and I started reading on March the 17th. And a phrase stuck in my mind that seemed so important to me, I don't know why, but it was simply this, that I must learn to wear the world as a loose garment and to live quietly with God at the center of my being. Something contrary to my whole nature was seeming very important to me. Well, my wife and her family had called me over to her sister's house to talk about divorce proceedings. And when they saw me this time, they saw a sick alcoholic rather than a sorry drunk. And they took me by way of the Veterans Hospital over to the Alcoholic Rehabilitation Center, where I ended up. They took me to John Umstead Hospital. They had to pull strings to get me in because it was Friday and they didn't take them except Monday through Wednesday. And when I went in to the center from John Umstead Hospital, they assumed that, I suppose, that I had had a physical examination over there because I near about died over there at ARC. I couldn't sign in or anything else. The first 3 or 4 days, I was at least on my feet. I was hopping around and jumping and jerking and one thing or another. And they said over there that if you went into convulsions, they'd send you over to the big hospital. Well, I got that thing figured out now. It takes a little strength to convulse, and I just didn't have it. And you've heard of coming off of it cold turkey. Well, at ARC, it was frozen buzzard, I'll tell you. The other patients would give you fruit juice and milk if they could. Finally, I was flat on my back, and I couldn't get out of the bed, and on that 8th night, I am as certain of anything in this world that I was dying. My breath would come in little short gasps and quite far apart. I was beyond the point of shaking. I was trembling and perspiring. I was mortally scared to death. I was so weak that if a rat had been sitting up here about to bite my nose, I don't believe I could have made a pass at it. Or if a drink had been sitting an inch from my hand, I couldn't have taken it. And for the first time in my life, I was backed into a corner, which I didn't have any ace up my sleeve, no tricks, nothing of the things I'd always wiggled out somehow or another. They just weren't there. And so, in simple, sobbing, childlike prayer, I said, God, please help me. And immediately, I became calm. At first, I felt a little suspended, and then I settled down into that mattress sort of like a inner tube does when you let the air out. I was scared. I didn't know what had happened. There was no flash of lightning or thunder, not even a still small voice. And I went to sleep, and I awakened the next morning refreshed and strong and hungry. And for the first time in my life, this fear, this unknown fear that had hounded me all my life was gone, and I had no desire or compulsion for a drink. My liver, which the night before I could hardly stand my pajamas against, the next morning was just as firm. I was hungry. I sat down and I wrote my wife a letter. I said, "Something has happened. I've had some sort of conscious contact. I don't understand it, but it's wonderful." This was not one of these cases that you read and hear about of letting go and letting God. Not this one. Because I hung on and hung on, and whatever I was hanging on to just broke, and I was caught up by the everlasting arms, an expression which I used to say was so corny. And you know, I went down into the lobby, of all things, to get breakfast and go through there, and several patients who'd been working with me looked and said, "What in the world has happened to you?" And here, with an opportunity to give the news of the greatest thing that ever happened to me, I was ashamed to tell them. I thought they'd laugh and that they wouldn't believe me. And I said, "I got a good night's sleep." Well, I'm no longer ashamed of it. I will shout it from the rooftops. I had had a conscious contact with God, and since then I have had other and fleeting and limited such contacts and many reassurances of these, and I shall look forward to some more of these. And it was back to AA to me, because in AA I had found a religious democracy or spiritual democracy I had never heard or seen anywhere else, in the nature of five words: God as I understand Him. God as this hard-headed mountaineer drunk chooses to understand Him, not as my wife or Billy Graham or the bishop or anyone else, but as I chose to understand Him. Well, I gave you my reasons a minute ago about belief in God, and I'll tell you now if there's any question in your mind. I believe in God in the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and I believe in the virgin birth and that God was His Father. And I know that God is vibrantly, powerfully, and lovingly alive. And in those areas in which it's said that He's dead, I suggest He's merely unemployed. So I took a whirl now at the 12 steps. And here I found myself trying to take the fourth step and not having had taken the third one. I thought this thing over at Butner took care of that, but it didn't. I hadn't even thanked him for that. Imagine anyone trying to look at the horrors of a personal inventory, fearless and moral inventory, without having turned your life over to God. Make you get drunk if you're not careful. So, sometime 2 or 3 months after leaving Butner, I had gone to a prayer group that my wife went to, and we listened to a tape by a man named Cliff Richmond, a non-alcoholic, talking on the Holy Spirit. He was a great Methodist layman, Russell. And I left there that night and wrote in the inside cover of my little 24-hour book, "Tonight I have asked the Holy Spirit to come into my life and to dominate my thoughts and actions, and I look for a new life." And my friends, it has been. I then took the fourth step, and it was still troublesome, but this was part of my life that I had turned over in the third step, and I could be forgiven. Right strange, in the fifth step, I took this with my pastor, took it with my boss, I took it with an in-law, and they said, "We just don't believe this. You're just being too hard on yourself." And I took parts of it with my wife, and she believed every word of it and told me how much I'd left out. But the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are wonderful. They're a challenge to the alcoholic. They're contrary to everything in his nature. And I'll say this, that if any person will try to conform his life to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, He will realize demands he never dreamed existed. But before he is halfway through, he will have built an archway through which he can walk a free man, and he never need to feel alone anymore. Now, so far, my attainment in the quest of these steps has only shed light upon the enormous distance that I still have to go. But if I cannot be discouraged by one miserable failure after another, then I might in the end turn out to be somewhat in the image of a good AA or a good Christian, and in my case that would be both. This is a beautiful program, a divinely inspired program. It's hard to describe, for us at least. A spiritual entity, a spiritual wholeness, that wherever it's ever been, its influence is never forgotten. Yes, we can say this. But sometimes those on the outside can say it better, either knowingly or not knowingly. I know that Dr. Frank Laubach, one of the great spiritual mystics of the day, in his little legend about the difference between heaven and hell under a similar, identical set of circumstances, he says that in hell they have a banquet table that the people come in to eat, a long rectangular table with benches along the sides, and they have narrow neck bowls in which the food is put. And they come in and they sit down to eat, but all of their elbows and their wrists are all stiff, and you can't bend them, get your food and get it to your mouth. And they sit there and flail about and argue and fight. And in heaven they have the identical situation, right on down to the stiff elbows and the stiff wrists. But these people reach across the table and feed each other out of each other's bowls. And that's AA. We feed each other. And that beautiful anonymous poem I first saw in Reader's Digest about 9 years ago. I sought my soul I could not see. I sought my God eluded me. And I sought my brother, and I found all three. And that's AA. We seek our brother, and we feed each other. Now, my friends, I can't get to meetings in the daytime. I can't get to meetings every night. And I'm a hard case. I need a lot to carry me through the day. And I've put together a little something that has come from many sources, the big book and the great big book, the great vine, the 12 by 12, good spiritual books by Tierney and Laubach and Sanford and various different others, to something that I can't call it a philosophy. I don't have that ability, and I keep it in the first person because I don't want to proffer advice. I guess I can call it a prayer. I entitle it Wearing the World as a Loose Garment. And I don't claim that I do it, but I claim that I try. And I find myself asking God to let me go calmly and quietly amid the noise and haste of this sick world. For this is a sick world. But if I wear it as a loose garment, I can still live in it. Let me take pride in my career, however humble that it may seem, for it is a treasure in the changing values of time. But let me be cautious in my business affairs, for the world is still full of trickery and dishonest machinations. But let me not be blind to what virtue that there is, for all around me high principles and high ideals are being practiced every day, and heroism is even still greatly in evidence. And let me not pretend affection, but neither let me be cynical about love, for it is the greatest thing in this world and is as perennial as the grass. It may look dead, but it will always return. And let me not compare myself with others, for there shall always be greater or lesser persons than myself. This is so vividly pointed out in the Beatitudes, the blessed, the meek, the long-suffering, the peacemakers, etc. I shall have my reward as a result of my own God-given talents and personality, and I need not copy anybody else. And let me remember that I am a child of this universe and that God is my Father. I have every right to be here as much as the stars and the trees and the animals and all the other people. And God being my Father, let me search deep into my soul in my prayers and meditations and become acquainted with the Holy Spirit that I know lives and dwells somewhere within me. For here lies the answer to all of my problems, if I draw upon it with faith, because all of the power and knowledge that I need is there. But let me not expect the results to come out on my timetable or my pattern, but on that of God's. He didn't make me a puppet on a string, and I certainly can't pull the string on Him. And so, with all of its heartaches and its sham and its wars and its riots and atomic power and all of the things that we fear, if I wear it as a loose garment, this is still a pretty wonderful world in which to live. Now, my friends, I know a miracle has taken place in my life. And I know that if I'm to keep this miracle alive and active, that there's things that I must do. I'm reminded that our Lord, when He performed miracles where people were concerned, in all the cases I know of, they were told to do something. The cripple by the pool at Bethesda, He said, take up thy bed and walk. All of them, right on down to Lazarus, who was dead and decomposing. He said, Lazarus, come forth. So I must do things. And first, I must keep my heart grateful to Almighty God, because in a grateful heart there's no room for resentment and self-pity. And I must live with Him at the center of my being. And I must carry the message. The big book so clearly tells me, and I look on the top of page 20 with this memory that I'm trying to use constructively now, that my very life as an ex-problem drinker depends upon my constant thought of the needs of others and how to help fill their needs. So I must carry the message in every possible way. And you know, I must seek the two greatest of human qualities, love and humility. And you know, if I had perfect love and perfect humility, I would have no fear in looking at the Ten Commandments. But I don't have perfect love and humility. And therefore, this Decalogue reflects to me like a mirror the sorry individual that I still am. But thank God for the promise of the gospel of the New Testament, because there's still hope there for me. And now let me say this in closing. May God, as each of us understand Him, keep us ever mindful of our responsibilities to the alcoholic who still suffers, so that we may pray about, think about, and look upon Him with true compassion and sincerely say, there but for the grace of God go I.